Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Always great to have him come by, and thank you so much for listening in. If you have a question for Phil, maybe there's some an insect you're curious about, or maybe there's something annoying you right now, I hope you'll give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page. You can post a comment or a question there, and that's at The Larry Mueller Show. Phil, great to see you.
Nice to be here.
And, you know, it's warming up. There's lots of insect activity out there right now.
It's holy cow.
Yeah.
I had gotten a lot of inquiries about just the general winter and effect on insect populations, and it really, you know, the only thing I see, if it gets real cold, we can eliminate some things, but nothing happened because the insects were dormant. But now we're getting to the stage, we're waking everybody up.
Yeah.
And it will be interesting. You can project pretty easily if it stays at these kind of 70 degree temperatures that everything's going to be 2-3 weeks early, which sometimes even means insects will go through additional generations. If, you know, it's extending the growing season, but, you know, we got a long way to go. But yes, definitely, I'm getting butterflies, ticks, all kinds of things come in the lab, and it's only going to continue. So.
Yeah. We were sitting out on our porch last night, sort of enjoying the evening, and saw a bat flying around. And, well, got to be some insects out here somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And, you know, most of this stuff, we got some critters that overwinter as adults, and you get above 50 degrees and whatnot, they can start being active. And as I said, it definitely is happening. And a whole bunch of other things kind of correlate. When the trees start to break bud and leaf out, a lot of eggs hatch and things get active. And what will be interesting is if it gets real warm and then we get a significant cold snap.
Yeah.
That could have major mortality.
Yeah.
Now, of course, our plants aren't going to be happy either, but it will slow some insects down if we get that pattern.
You know, we already have something posted up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and a pretty cool-looking insect from Mary. She says, I think it's a stink bug. Is it too early or just about right for the unusually warm weather?
Okay, well, it is a green stink bug, although there are three species
of
green
stink
bugs.
It's bright green.
Right, and they overwinter as adults, so this is one of those examples of something that has been teased out and started to walk around. Although this is from a group of plant-feeding stink bugs, there are some that eat other insects that are predators, but really not much of a problem. The only bad news I've got for folks is that this Chinese brown marmorated stink bug that has been such a pest out east, we in January got a couple cases of overwintering here that we know they're breeding in the state, one up in Green Bay and one out of Middleton, and so it's going to take a while for that one to come, but to give you some perspective, it's going to be the equivalent of Japanese beetle as far as problems, but more on fruits and vegetables and even some crop issues, and it does invade your house like Asian lady beetle, so it's going to be a very unpopular critter.
Well, I'm sure we'll be learning more about that as time goes on. We have another Facebook comment, and that has to do with something I wanted to bring up, too, is tick population. Sandy Sawchuk was on my show yesterday as a veterinarian. She's pulling ticks like crazy off the dogs, so they're out there.
Yeah, we can't correlate mild winters with increased ticks. It really isn't a strong correlation there, but, you know, with this deer tick issue that's been in the state for about the last two decades, because they overwinter as adults, as soon as there's no snow on the ground and it warms up to above 50, they're active. And so the pattern has been such that we've been seeing ticks coming in for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, I don't think they're going to be any worse, but they've been moderately bad in general. And, you know, of course, the cases of Lyme disease continue to climb.
Yeah.
And so it's something you do have to pay attention to if you're getting out in the woods.
Let's turn to Chuck in Lake Delton next. Hi, Chuck. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you for having the show. See, I've been fighting these coniferous seed bugs. And I looked on the UW website, and it doesn't have much information. It's got a beautiful picture, but it doesn't have much information on them.
Well, if you go on my website and get underneath the extension bulletins under the home, there is a information sheet on Western conifer seed bug, so it kind of gives you the details. But really what it's about is, as the name implies, they feed on the seeds of pine and spruce, but in the fall of the year, they invade your house to spend the winter in the shelter. And then you get these warm days, they wake up. And so it really isn't worth doing it much now. If you're going to draw a line in the sand, it's in the fall. And the two options are to either get things sealed well enough so they can't sneak in, which may not be a reasonable request, or there are sprays that can be put on the outside, but this has to be done in September. And well, so that's the window.
Well, the thing last year, now, they were all over my outside garage and stuff like that. Now, I sprayed them with soap and water, and it seemed to, you know,
knock them down anyway.
Sure.
Well, it kills them pretty good. But now, it said on the Google website that they lay their eggs on the tips of the pine trees. But now, do they bore into the bark of the pine trees?
No. And what happens is the little tiny bugs crawl around on the cones, and then they have a sucking mouth part, and they feed on the starches that are associated with the seeds. And so that's how they go through their cycle. And, you know, unless you're producing seed, so, you know, in nurseries that they produce seed for pine, this would be a pest. But for the rest of us, it's more of a nuisance. And the thing about the soap is it works quite well, but there's no residual. So right, you only kill the critters you get, whereas there are some sprays you can get at the hardware store that if you were to put on the sunny sides of the house where they congregate, it will continue to kill them for upwards of 3 to 4 weeks. You know, it's kind of a preference thing. There's nothing wrong with the soap. It just means you have to be more labor intensive than you would be if you use some of these residual sprays.
Otherwise. it was pretty labor intensive when I was spraying them. No doubt about that. But we had cut down a whole bunch of big pines last year. See, and that was the first year that after we cut those down, that was the first year that we had a big
infestation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it might be interesting now if those plants are removed. That means there's less food, and one would suggest it depends a little bit on how many pine trees are around, and but that may improve the situation over time, I would think.
Yeah. Chuck, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. By the way, you can join in, too, if you have a question for our guest today, Phil Pelletieri. We're talking about the world of insects with him today. Maybe you're noticing some insects right now, or maybe you're having some troubles with some particular kinds of insects. Talk ticks as well. 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call. Or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. We already had one really cool photo. And just sort of in the spirit of St. Patty's, that bug is...
It's green as green as they get.
About as green as it gets. Shirley and Prentice, let's go to you now. Hi, Shirley. Thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry. For the last 2 years, when the weather gets warm, I begin to see some little black specks on my kitchen counter, maybe on the stove. That's about the only places. And they're not really specks. They're like a piece of black thread, very fine, and maybe a 16th of an inch long. And I have ladybugs in the house now, and I'm wondering, would that be droppings from the ladybugs?
Ladybug droppings tend to be liquidy and tend to be more yellowish in color.
Oh.
So it's kind of more of a, when it dries, almost a varnishy spot.
Yeah, not the ladybugs then.
Yeah, in other critters, you know, that have more of a dry waste, it's usually more pelleted.
Oh.
So my first inclination, at least when people send me samples like that, it often turns out to be fibers, you know, just clothing fibers that are floating around and get stuck on things. But I said, that's a guess just with what I see. I'd be happy to take a peek if you can get some of those and send them down to me and so I can get them under a microscope to be sure. But my first inclination, it's not insect waste.
If I touch it with my finger, it kind of sticks sometimes, but not really.
Yeah. Now, outdoors, we have a little bit more interesting issue is people get these dark black specks that get stuck on their siding, and it turns out it's not insect related. They call it spider poop, but it turns out to be the spores of artillery fungus, which is something that grows on the mulch that we use, and they literally shoot the spores, and they really become quite problematic because they're difficult to get off without hurting the siding. And again, I can see where people would think it's insect waste, but this one happens to be related to a fungus.
Yeah, and those black specks, we have our home on the lake is kind of a bright yellow.
Oh, dear. I know exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Those specks are pretty much impossible to get rid of.
The discussion on what kind of things will melt that away, you know, and people use trisodium phosphate and other things that are really, you know, really kind of moderately harsh chemicals, and even there's no guarantee with those.
Thanks again, Shirley, for calling. Aaron in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We are on to you now. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
We have tons of box elder bugs that are in our yard, but they also get in our house. We have a southern exposure kitchen that has white cabinetry and some part of the walls are white. And, I mean, we will probably get, like, 15 to 20 in there per day, but only, you know, for a few weeks right now in the spring and then a few weeks in the fall, too. And so it's quite a nuisance because it's, of course, very unappetizing.
Sure.
And then outside there are, supposedly we have a female box elder tree or something. I'm not sure if that's the right thing. The neighbor does. And then so they will be all over that tree, and then they'll be all over, we have an alley garage because it's an older home, so they'll be all over the garage. And we've sprayed them with soap and water, and that seems to upset them, but they'll just move to another part of the garage or the tree. And then, but well, I don't know if you have any hints about what to do.
Well, two things. The soap and water can get interesting. This is an old one. I honestly tell this quite a bit when I'm teaching Master Gardener programs, that one of my favorite remedies for killing box elder bugs comes from a colleague at Iowa State, and it was a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water. And we're doing a show with Larry, and somebody said, I tried Cheer, and it didn't work. And it turns out that soap chemistry is such, if you really want to get the right stuff, there is an insecticidal soap product sold at nurseries. So that would be the first thing to consider. Secondly, much like the conversation we had a little earlier with the conifer seed bug, is the soap gives you contact, and it will kill them. And if it didn't kill them, again, my argument would be it's the wrong kind of soap. But if you're investing that kind of time and effort, I think it's better to put on a residual insecticide, you know, something like permethrin or bifenthrin, or, I mean, there's a whole lot of them available. Spray it on the sunny side of the house, and it's all about what you do in the fall. Because the ones that you're seeing now have already crawled into your wall, spent the whole winter, and now they're waking up. And we really can't do much about that. So either you stop them before they crawl in with being pretty aggressive. And you'll see this ebb and flow from year to year. General trends tend to be dry years in the late summer are more problematic because we don't get natural control. Although that theory got a little bit dinged because in 2010, when it was so wet, I expected very few box elder bugs, and it was a pretty bad year. In comparison, at least the complaints I've gotten this, you know, in the last year in the lab and whatnot, I would say that 2011 was somewhat less of a population. But with that said, if you're in the right place, you still get box elder bugs. Yeah. So again, I would go back to the strategy of trying to figure out how they're sneaking in, although your numbers are relatively low from what you're telling me. So things must be really reasonably tight around the kitchen. But when they congregate in the fall, spraying them at that time and knocking them down, and again, with something with residual, you do the job thorough enough, it will probably knock back 95-98%. You always expect a few to trickle through. But that would be, as I said, don't bother now. Just kind of sweep them up. Let them go.
Get rid of them.
Whatever you do now isn't going to influence what's going to happen in the fall. They go through two generations or cycles on those trees, and it really depends more on the weather this summer and if they're going to do well or not.
There you go. All right, thanks.
Oh, wait, sorry, one more thing. So do you think it would help if we got anything resealed in our house?
Oh, definitely. The old argument with that is if you figure out how they're getting in, you have a permanent solution. So you have to check your attic vents, you have to check your soffit vents, you got to check your siding. In newer houses, they often use Tyvek and other wraps around, which what happens is the box elder bugs sneak under the siding, but they can't get in because there's this barrier. But the same thing happens on a warm day. You see a bunch of bugs clustered on the outside. And, you know, as long as they're not getting in the house, I think most people are tolerant of that. But if they're pouring in through something and you figure out where that weakness is and get it sealed up and keep them out, as I said, then you can forget about the chemicals because they're not going to bother you in the kitchen.
There you go. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Aaron. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest today as we talk the world of insects. Amanda Magnus, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about insects that are troubling you, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can do that. Just a quick note that Thursday, April 5th, I'll be hosting the second annual Wisconsin Public Radio Listener Dinner. It's going to be at Milwaukee's Mitchell Park Domes. Probably see a few bugs inside the domes. I usually do. And I'll be doing a mock garden talk show with gardening guru Melinda Meyer. So it's a great chance to meet not only me, but WPR host Kathleen Dunn's going to be there. Ben Marins, Chuck Quernbach, our Milwaukee bureau reporter, will be there. So we're going to have some great food, music, lovely greenery of the domes, and a lot of fun with WPR staff and listeners. So go to www.wpr.org/Larry Mealer for more information. The deadline to register is coming up. It's March 21st, and we've got, I know we have a few spots left, so please act soon. And now let's go to Linda in Madison. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm having a problem with small black flies that are getting into my condo. I've had them for like the last couple of years. They usually come in the spring, but now they've, you know, I've been seeing them at, you know, starting the end of February, and I'm killing them every day. I'm not sure how they're getting in and what to do to basically get rid of them and to prevent them getting in. And I live on the second floor in a condo, so I'm not sure if they're coming through like the vents in the ceiling or what.
Mm-hmm. Now, about the size of a house fly, maybe a little smaller, or are they?
Oh, they're real small. They're real small.
Okay.
They're
then I'm going to ask you to send me a critter, because flies are particularly difficult for people to describe. There's three or four different small flies. There's a small dung fly. There is a drain fly. I even find sometimes people find fruit flies. There is a bigger group of species than the normal fruit flies you see. And so, I'm seeing a lot of these house fly size things, which are cluster flies that come in the fall. It's another one of these fall invaders, but it doesn't sound like it fits that pattern. So, as I said, I need to see the critter to be able to give you a decent answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if it helps to let you know, when I do kill them, because I've been killing them every day, they leave like a red mark.
Okay.
A small red mark.
That makes me a little more suspicious it's fruit flies.
Okay,
because fruit flies have a maroon or red type eye in many cases and species, and that's not typical of many other of the flies that I deal with. And now, fruit flies, what people have to understand is that the immature stage or maggot feeds on yeast, and the yeast is associated with things that are overly ripe. Now, the seasonality is a little bit hard to explain, because that would suggest something in a wall where the temperatures were too cold in the dead of winter. That being said, as I said, I still think it's worth sending it in. Let's just make sure that we're not going the wrong direction here.
And then how does she do that?
Address is 1630 Linden Drive, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. If you just send it to the insect lab, I will get it. If you're ever on campus, we're across from the Babcock Ice Cream Parlor in Russell Laboratories. My lab is up on the second floor. And people come in all the time with critters for me to take a look at. As long as I'm in there, I do travel at times because of responsibilities. But even if I'm not around, you can leave them with the office.
Sure.
And the other thing is, if you got a good camera, I mean, the interesting thing now is about 50% of what I'm processing are digital images. And most of the time, people can take good enough pictures. But with flies, it's going to have to be a moderate magnification for me to see the detail I need.
Yeah, probably. And by the way, we also have a link to the Insect Diagnostic Lab on my Facebook page. So if you just go to the Larry Mealer Show, if you need that information, go there and you can get the address and all the other information you need. Actually, if you had a magnified photo, might work too.
Yes.
But it little dicey. But thanks, Linda, for calling. Joe in Monona, it is your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Well, I don't know if you've got time to play a guessing game, But yesterday I left the screen door open and the door open so the dog could go in and out without bothering him or me. And I had a visitor, a little visitor. And I'll bet you it's the first one of the year. I don't know. And I was real surprised. So if you don't want to guess, I'll just tell you.
Well, I can cheat because I can see on the board that you told the screener
mosquito.
That was a mosquito.
I thought I saw one last night, too.
I got
swatted one.
Okay, so the story here is we've got 54 species of mosquitoes in the state, and although most overwinter as eggs, we do have a handful of species that overwinter as adults. What's important about that group is this is the genus Culex, which is the one that spreads West Nile, among other things, and so it does have some significance. They typically overwinter in tree holes, caves, other kinds of things, and when you get the first warm-up, again, because they're in the adult stage, they can start to fly. So it could be, we even see these in people's basements, because that's similar to a cave, and they'll just sit on the wall all winter long, and then all of a sudden things warm up and they're off. And so I do get people that get, mosquito bites in December, and then my first question is, do you have a bedroom in the basement? The thing about it, though, there's no way they can breed indoors. And so it was just unfortunate one came in. I really wouldn't worry that much about it. But just like the robin is the first sign of spring from an entomological perspective, the first mosquito kind of takes us there. So
there you go.
I was in the house minding my own business, and this thing flew past me.
Yeah.
No, it definitely. And as I said, I even one year in, I had a specimen submitted in January, which is really quite a record. But it was a 60-degree day. You know, those things can happen. And definitely what's going on now with, you know, as I said, a lot of things are waking up. And so it definitely is easily in the realm of possibility.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Joe, I want to go to Barbara next in Sauk County. Hi, Barbara.
Yes, hi. I have noticed a little tan moth about maybe a quarter of an inch narrow. Wondering if it's a clothing moth problem. It's in my bedroom.
It's a small
one. It could be, but most likely not. The most common little moth we get indoors is more of a pantry pest. It's called an Indian meal moth. And if you ever get lucky enough to catch one, the Indian meal moth is bigger than the clothes moth is a very tiny little critter. The other thing is it'll be two-toned. It has kind of a darker, almost a maroonish wingtip with more of a tan shoulder to it. But so typically you find it in dog food, cereals, you know, grain-based things. In the bedroom, people often forget about things like potpourri, Christmas wreaths made out of walnuts, anything that's got plant-based stuff, even something like a dried flower arrangement. So if the source was there, there would be a food pest. And the good thing about the food pest is they will not bother clothing. Now, clothes moths, typically people don't see the adults because they're very secretive. They like to stay in dark hiding places. Although occasionally you'll run into them. But then I would check woolens and silk in particular because they have to feed on high protein fiber. So cloth like cotton will not support them. Rayon will not support them. But these natural fibers could.
Would either of them be involved in house plants?
No. Because it's got to be dried plant material, so green growing stuff, no way.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. We have a question. I think it might have been a Facebook question. Someone's having a Japanese beetle issue with rose bushes. Tried the dish soap thing, and it helped. This is, of course, last year. Mm-hmm. We treated the areas around the bushes with the white powder stuff. I guess we'll see. But I'm worried since we have such a warm winter. I love my roses. And so do the Japanese beetles. I can attest to that. Yes.
Okay, a couple things to consider. The Japanese beetles that are bothering your lawn are flying in from down the road. You have no control of that.
So
one expects them to be there. Interesting thing about weather patterns. It was dry enough late last summer that my colleague Chris Williamson, who does a lot of work with Japanese beetles, tells me that the populations have suffered to some degree.
Huh.
Now, that's relative, because if I said they had a 50% population reduction, we'd be dancing in the streets, and there's still going to be way too many in your backyard. So I guess I would say I would get my control measures in order before they come. The normal date is towards the last of June. It'll probably stay that way, but if this weather gets this crazy, to see the first Japanese beetle on the 15th of June wouldn't surprise me.
No.
Because insects, being cold-blooded, they develop like you bake a cake. The warmer the oven, the faster it happens. Options, you can put physical barriers, you know, little netting over the plants to help protect them. There are various insecticides. There are systemics. The dilemma with the systemics is that one treatment on the roots will protect the leaves all season long, but will not protect the flowers at all because they don't go into the flowers. The other options with sprays with more residual than the soap will last for a week, and the beetles fly for 2 months. So this is not an easy critter to fight. I mean, it's a constant battle, and as we've talked about before, it is by far the worst ornamental headache that you can have in the insect world in this state by far.
We have sort of related to that, and actually not sort of, it is. Chris in Madison wondered what you thought about milky spore powder, its effectiveness on Japanese beetles. Impact. I'm also wondering about the impact on beneficial insects and the potential of this fungus to spread in our environment.
Okay. Milky spore is a bacterium that has toxins that only kill Japanese beetles, so they don't affect anything else. In the way it is utilized is you put the spores on your lawn and the beetles ingest it, become infected, and honestly reproduce the spores. So they multiply the number of spores that are in your lawn. These spores don't go anywhere. They don't blow. So they're kind of localized. a couple comments about this. One is that the only way you justify using this is if your lawn is being destroyed by Japanese beetle. Again, my comments about most of our problems come in from beetles down the road. So you can treat your lawn with milky spore, and it's not going to have an effect on what happens to your birch trees or your roses, and so that has to be understood. An advantage of milky spore is one treatment will, under right conditions, be semi-permanent, but you need a certain grub density to make it kick in. I will tell you, in the laboratory, there are far better bacteria that are being looked at and may be eventually developed. The milky spore is kind of not as good as it used to be, and we think it's a quality control problem.
Oh.
And so I don't have anything against it, but I'm really not, in many cases, finding it's the solution for a person's problem. As I said, if you had significant grub problems in the lawn, it would be one of the options, in environmentally a very good option. But for the kind of problems most people are dealing with, milky spore will not be very helpful.
Let's turn to Chris in Sussex next. Hi, Chris.
Hi. What do you do about centipedes?
Got a few of them. If you move everything out of your house, and so it's kind of barren landscape, you may have a chance of getting rid of them. It's a couple things. The centipede that most people find indoors is a tropical species. It's not found naturally outside, but it can thrive indoors. Centipedes are predators, so they eat insects. So one of the strategies is you try to eliminate as many other critters as you can so there's less centipede food. The problem with them is that they like places like walls and attics, so they're in places you can't get to. And so this is why I can give you some suggestions to reduce the numbers, but as far as magically making them all go away, it's not easy. I mean, the teasing about removing things, the more clutter you have, the more places they have to hide, which makes them harder to get to. So that's one issue. So one of the things that we do suggest that helps is you can go to the hardware store and buy basically, we call them glue boards. There are versions of this sold for mice and rat traps. There's also smaller versions that you can use for insects, but you can use the mouse version. And you stick it back in corners, and if a centipede crawls across it, it gets caught in this tacky material, and it's
done.
Dead. And centipedes are slow to breed. It's not like you ever get overrun with them, but part of the reason you don't get overrun is there's not a lot of food for them. So the sticky boards I like probably is the best treatment, and you put it back in the corners where they're kind of been active, and it will help reduce numbers. If you want to use sprays, any indoor ant spray will help knock them down. I would not spray my basement because spraying concrete is very ineffective. It's just not a good substrate. So usually you want to spray wood. And again, back in areas where you see activity, reducing the amount of moisture in the basement will help to some degree. Wet, damp basements have more centipedes than dry. So those are all things that will help. But as far as magically making them go away, it doesn't happen. Now, the good news is that they really are relatively harmless. I mean, they're real creepy. They got big, long legs. They run real fast. You turn on the light, they're running around the kitchen. And so I understand how people have a hard time with them. But in the scheme of things, they really are harmless. Although if you were to pick one up, they could bite you. I dare you to catch one.
Yeah.
Because they're so quick. So as I said, they have a big time creep factor, but really not much to worry about. But you can do some things, I think, that will help reduce the numbers.
Be great, because I don't like them. I used to make my husband get them. Yeah.
There you go. Well, let's see. We got a picture here. Gotta identify this small moth from our Facebook page, and I can't see the moth in the picture.
Yeah, I'm looking hard too, and I just can't quite pick it up. Oh, I can. Yes, I can. Right in the center of it, it almost looks like part of the flower.
That.
Yeah, that.
Interesting.
So my first take on it, and with thousands of species of moths, and this is going to be kind of a wild guess, but the size and the way it holds its wings suggest it's in the leaf roller family, which we call the tortricids.
About the size of pinky fingernail,
yeah,
she said.
Pretty small, kind of triangular in shape, just the way the markings are. There are a number of different leaf rollers. Most of them are pretty innocent creatures, but that's what I would think, is that it is one of the leaf rollers. And as again, I'm doing it more on the general size, the color patterns on the wings, and the way it sits at rest. And so if you look under fruit tree leaf roller and red banded leaf roller, you'll see some other moths that look similar, although this doesn't appear to be one of those two species.
All right, there we go. And Mark and Mozanee, it is your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Taking the call.
What's on your mind? We lose him? Ah, I think we lost him.
Well, the thing that Mark, again, I can pick up from the board from what Amanda had gotten for us, flies on the outside. I think these are cluster flies waking up. A lot of times, again, if your house is sealed real well, you didn't see the flies indoors, but they were under your siding. And I quite commonly, on the first sunny, warm days of spring, get people that have lots of flies sitting around, and this would fit the pattern. Now, they don't hurt anything, and they're going to be flying off. These are earthworm parasites by nature, and so, you know, they're going to go off and do their thing with earthworms. And I would just let them be. I mean, I don't think it's worth it. You could use the soapy water if you want. You could use a residual insecticide. I think that's more justified in the fall to stop them from coming in. But in the spring, when they want to leave, that's what we want them to do. So that would be my comment. If they look kind of like houseflies, it's too early for houseflies to be here. It's too early for blowflies to be active. But cluster flies could be waking up.
Gail in Door County. Hello.
Hey. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had to narrow it down to one thing, to get to it, the cluster flies. We had had cluster flies, and in my investigations with it, and then I tried out a cure, we had them in the area, and they were only in the on the wall where it gets the hottest. That's kind of like where they congregated. But it turned out that they were also hanging around and coming from our neighbor's compost pile. He's got the one out of several neighbors here. So we got the Spalding cluster, the fly predator, and you get those little guys in the little packet, and you sprinkle them around, and that kind of got rid of them. And okay. Even for our neighbors, and they're totally benign. People use them around horses and,
sure.
And farms. Work. Have you used them before?
Well, the issue is that the cluster fly is not affected by those parasites. The only flies that would be are house fly and similar ones, and so I'm not so sure you had cluster flies.
Well, it got rid of them.
Yeah, whatever it was, they're gone.
The only thing that I'm a little concerned about here is typically house flies, there's not enough organic matter of the right sort in a compost pile. Now, if they were putting meat scraps and other things in there, there could be, and that would breed. But just vegetative debris in a compost pile is not the right kind of stuff. And so the Spalding predators do work if you match it with the right kind of fly.
Mm-hmm.
But without seeing it, it's a chance that you hit a home run here and you did match it, but there's also a chance it's just coincidental. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, whatever it was,
it
those
worked.
Little guys work.
Thanks, Gail. Thank you very much for calling. An email from another Gail, as a matter of fact. Would you talk about mason bees? Once you have a proper home for them, what kind of care do you need to provide mason bees?
Okay, so mason bees, you can commercially buy bee boards that have their grubs already in them, and you pay a pretty penny for them, and they ship them out of the Washington state and whatnot. And what we always tell people is that we already have them here. And so if you provide the right kind of home, there's a moderately good chance you will get mason bees and other creatures. And what they're providing them is the equivalent of a 3/8 inch diameter straw. So mm-hmm. Some people will drill holes into wood. Some people will construct various varieties of this. I've seen people that take a bunch of boards, drill them, and put them together. And so the mason bees will go out and collect pollen, put it in this tube, lay their egg, and their grubs will develop. Typically, you want to put this so it gets a good sun exposure in the morning, so it kind of wakes things up. And mason bees are one of the first bees to be active. That's why they're so popular for pollination, is they're active before honeybees and at lower temperatures. And we have more than one native species in the state. As far as what to do, though, is when they're done in the spring, when we know that they've emerged and they're starting to get their things going, sometimes it does help to clean out those tubes. Because there's enough debris in there, and there's other critters that move in. Some people get grumpy when other critters move in, but they're usually other beneficial pollinators, and so I think it's good to provide. And if you change the diameter of the holes, you're going to attract different species of bees, among other things. But you will find that some of the people that sell you just a mason bee house without the grubs, again, have designed it in a way it can be cleaned. And again, much as there's a variation a gentleman up in Marionette County has come up with. And as I said, it's got screws on it. When you're all done, you can take it apart, clean things out, put all the pieces of boards back together, screw it tight, and you're ready to go. You would not do that right now because they're still in the grub stage. They're just coming out. But probably in about 2 weeks, if we know the bees are out being active, quickly clean it up, provide them a new house, and we're ready.
Go right back in. Put it right back where it was.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Jerry in Prairie du Chien. It's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. Good morning.
Morning.
I've got two questions about carpenter ants.
Okay.
One is, I heard a recipe last year but misplaced it using the poison boric acid mixed in water with a, then dipping a cotton wad, wad of cotton in it and leaving that cotton wad out moist for the ants, for them to get the moisture in there for the poison.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know what that recipe is? And secondly, what is the risk to the home if carpenter ants are present?
Okay. Let's start with the first one, because we should not have called them carpenter ants, because the implication is they eat your house and it falls down, and the reality is they don't eat wood at all. They live in rotting wood. And so the association is if you have a rotting windowsill, the ants move in, you find it, the ants will get blamed for the windowsill rotting, but it was the moisture that did it. So they're a nuisance. You can argue that they're beneficial because they point out where you've got a moisture problem, and that's the structural issue in the house. Now, boric acid is a stomach poison, so you somehow have to get them to feed on it. So just boric acid crystals don't work. What I've seen, if you buy taro ant poison, it's basically honey and boric acid. And so in the case of the water here, if you added something else the ants were interested in, mint apple jelly, honey, they have both a sweet tooth but also a protein need, and it depends on what they need to feed their young. The protein is more for raising young. So you're almost better off to buy the commercial ant baits. There's a number of them that have boric acid in there, but if you're trying to do your own home remedy, the only problem with the home remedies is if the stuff dries out, it becomes far less attractive to the ants. And so, you know, they are a liquid feeder, believe it or not. And so that's the trick in to buy the pre-made stuff. It, you know, it's easy to find. It's not very expensive. And again, understanding that it has to be ingested. And then the whole thought is that if the dosage is too high, you kill the ant before it gets back and it gets a chance to feed the other ants. And that's not what you want. You want it to be a low dosage so that it feeds other ants and they feed the queen. And once we kill the queen, we've solved the problem.
Yep. It's all over with. Thank you very much for calling, Jerry. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. In early July, I'll be leading a group of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners to London, and we'll be touring English gardens, attending the Hampton Court Flower Show. It's the biggest flower show in the world. We'll also visit some of England's great churches and houses along with their gardens. I know we're going to see some cathedrals and the White Gardens of Sackville West and Bateman's House. That was the retreat of Rudyard Kipling, so that's going to be fun. And then we're going to have a whole day at the Hampton Court Flower Show, and we'll also be getting a private tour of the Secret Gardens of London, and so that's going to be pretty cool. You can check out the whole itinerary at WPR.org/travel. We'll be going July 1st through July 9th, and I'll be there, and I know it's going to be a lot of fun. So go to WPR.org/travel, and you'll learn some more about it. And we have Ryan. I had an email question for you, Phil. One night in February, I saw a small brown spider with thin, long legs. Instead of killing it or photographing it, I left it alone. I know it sounds unlikely, but I thought it was very similar to the brown recluse. Later, when I got in front of a computer and had the opportunity to look up brown recluse, it looked exactly like it. Have any populations been found in Madison, Wisconsin?
Do I have to answer that? Yes, but it's probably not a recluse. We have a number of spiders that are much more common that are little brown spiders. What's distinctive about a recluse is you have to get close enough to see that they only have six eyes. Yeah, six eyes rather than eight, and they have this very distinctive fiddle violin on the cephalothorax. The interesting thing about recluse is, thanks to the internet, it has even gotten more infamous, but not deservingly so. I mean, it turns out that we found that half the cases that were getting diagnosed as recluse bites, which are usually slow-healing ulcerations, turn out to be staph infections and not spider bites alone. So a lot of people have gotten diagnosed. I talked to somebody this morning whose sister was up in Green Bay, didn't know she was bit by a spider, got a reaction, went, called it recluse. I've never seen one out of Green Bay. I don't believe it.
Yeah.
Type of thing. And so I'm really doubting unless, and even the cases I know of recluse, in the small number of cases we bumped into it in the state, and I've only seen it about seven or eight times in my 34 years of running the lab, nobody's been bit. We just found the spider. And so they're not thriving up here by any means. And in fact, the interesting question that I can't answer for you is why not? I mean, central Illinois is the normal northern range, and we know they're brought in all the time, but they just don't take hold. And, you know, maybe it's too dry in the winter. You can speculate at that. So the chance of it being recluse is very small, but even if it was, it's really not that big a deal.
Didn't you tell me once that there was a household with that had a whole bunch of brown recluse spiders?
The person that has helped clarify this and has a lot of great information on his website is Dr. Rick Vetter, who's over in Cal Riverside. And so if you do a Vetter and spider search, you'll get his site. And he had a family he worked with down in the St. Louis area, rural St. Louis, that they captured over 1,000 spiders in about a 3 or 4 month period of time in their old farmhouse, which is a great place for these spiders to be. Nobody ever got bit. You know,
and, 1,000 brown recluse
spiders in these little sticky board traps. So it was overrun with them, and they weren't having problems. And as I said, you got to be very careful because a lot of cases that are presented on the internet turn out not to be. And as I said, Rick has clarified that quite a bit, both publishing extensively in the dermatology journals so that the medical community, I think, can get aware of some of these questions and again, misdiagnosis. Now, from the other hand, I can see you walk in the emergency room and you have an ulceration. I know why they go to the spider bite first. If I lived in Arkansas, that's exactly where I would go for as a physician. But in Wisconsin, where the spiders are extremely rare, I don't think so. And as I said, we've got so many lookalikes that without a close examination of the markings in the eye patterns, I don't think so.
Okay. Tom in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hello. For the past couple of years, I've had a recurring nest of they look like very small bumblebees in the ground in my backyard, and I have, you know, a small child, and she has her friends over and so forth, and it's just too dangerous to have them around, and I'm wondering what the best method to try and rid my lawn of these bees would be.
They're not diggers by themselves. They're looking for old rodent burrows, washed out areas under slabs. So by eliminating those in the spring, what will happen very shortly, the first queen bumblebees will be waking up, coming out of their overwintering sites. They will look for these kind of habitats to start the nest. And so by physically eliminating them, you know, plugging the holes, that's all you've got to do. If we get farther down the line, you know, what I always tell people is, you know, the only time bumblebees are a threat is if the nest is disturbed. So if this was in your back 40, you say don't bother, but if it's where the kids and the dogs play, then the option is an insecticide dust works better than a spray. You just dust the entrance, and when they come and go, that will do them in. But as I said, for now, I would just eliminate habitat. And if you see an old chipmunk burrow, fill it in, because that's exactly what the bumblebees are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And sometimes cavities around, if you've got flower set up with brick and stuff along the side of the house, they'll sometimes get under there.
Or even mulch piles. You often get little pockets in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they find it, again, they're looking for a protected habitat where they will raise their young and whatnot. So we start with a single queen. Colonies can build up to a couple hundred bumblebees in the late fall or late summer. And then they produce the new queens, the males, for the first time. And that's how the cycle continues. But they don't go back to the same nest, and they can't survive the winter other than the fertilized queens.
Ryan in Onalaska, let's see if we can turn to you, though. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hope you guys are doing well today.
We are.
I know that those box elder bugs, they get trashed on and get kind of a bad rap a lot of times. When I was younger, we used to get them along the whole side of our house, and my parents were kind of anti-chemical. They didn't want to use them, and I still kind of carry that tradition on. And I just wanted to say, you know, to anybody that isn't absolutely overrun with those guys, you know, they're actually, I've found to be the friendliest of bugs out there, if there is such a thing. I actually had one in my office the other day, and the little guy, you know, he's crawling on my coffee cup, and I kind of let him crawl on my finger. You know, if you get a couple of them in the house, they're, you know, it's almost just as easy just to let one crawl on your hand, and you can bring them right outside. And, you know, they seem pretty friendly and entertaining to me. So I just kind of wanted to say something pro box elder bug. And, and in their defense, I was just wondering, too, are there any benefits to their existence?
Well, I can think of one, because box elder is considered a weedy tree, and we know that their feeding is going to affect the viability of the seed, and so they're reducing the amount of box elder seed out there. So that to me, would be a benefit. I mean, I can agree with you. I mean, my perspective is I'm used to dealing with bugs, and so they don't freak me. But I understand some people don't like them. But if you look at it, there's no disease. They don't bite. They don't breed in your house. I mean, they're a nuisance. That's about the full extent of dealing with them. And as I said, as you say, in the spring of the year, just brush them out. You can just sweep them out. You don't even have to touch them. But if you're going to fight the fight, it's in the fall. One of the other options sometimes, and this works if you've only got one or two isolated trees and it's on your property, you remove the trees, there's nothing for them to breed on. They're gone. Where are we getting problems if the tree's in the neighbors or you got a big woodlot in back of you? That kind of sanitation is not going to work.
Thanks for calling, Ryan. Appreciate your call. And I should have given that number a little while back here because we've got open lines now. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. John emailed and wondered, how do I keep wasps from nesting behind my shutters?
Probably the only thing is to use steel wool or some kind of plugging in those little void spaces so they can't get access. Yeah. Again, you could spray in the spring when the queens are coming in, although this is a case, generally speaking, not so much what you use, but formulation. I like to use a dust in a void space. It works far better than a spray. So do you want to go through the bother of dusting each time? Or again, if you go in and plug the holes, that's permanent. We've taken the habitat away. We never have to do it again.
We have also we've got some more emails here, and I know... powder post beetles, an email from Sandy in New Berlin. We've had professional attention via spray to get rid of powder post beetles. It worked, but only to a point. Is there any hope that we can ever be totally free of these pests? They're in our hardwood floors, and the spray was applied from the basement as well as the floor surfaces.
Okay, well, I wish I could talk to Sandy to get some more background to see how old are the floors and the like, because that does play in. Generally speaking, powder post beetle over time has a difficult time indoors in Wisconsin because our wood gets too dry in the winter. But the problem with them is if they're in an inch deep into an oak board, one of the strategies is to strip the floor. They put a borate solution, so it's similar to boric acid, which is a stomach poison, but that only penetrates a couple millimeters. The powder post beetles have to come up to the surface to feed on that. One of the problems with this treatment is if the wood is sealed in any form, you have to literally sand it because the borates won't soak in, and that's the trick here. So it's an access question. You know, sometimes what you find, you can't spray every square inch you need to, but a board that's treated properly will become powder beetle proof over time. And so there are ways of eliminating it. Most of the time you see it's really more of a cosmetic damage. But again, my question would be is if this is a newer floor where they came in with you, I would be very curious if this was an old floor that never had a problem and then it surfaced. Although the first place I go when I hear that story is we've got more moisture in the environment than is normal. Because they said typically the moisture levels we dry our wood out in the middle of the winter, whether you use furnace or wood burner, is getting it at a level where powder post beetles have a very difficult time of thriving. Whereas if you have it in a crawl space or somewhere else where we've got lots of moisture, then they are more successful. And you've got to be patient. There's no treatment I know other than to dry it with a kiln that instantly kills them. So if the treatment was done 4 or 5 months ago, it may take another year or two to see the ultimate elimination of the population.
We had on our Facebook, Julia in Fort Atkinson emailed us a photo, wondering any idea what kind of spider this is. It's about the size of a nickel.
Mm-hmm. So the pattern of the banding legs of the very ornate abdomen, all those neat markings.
Yeah, it's very cool.
So this is an orb weaver spider. So it's related to the garden spiders. This one is probably in the genus Neonectis, would be my first guess, but that's not important. It's an adult female, common in the late summer, always very careful or colorful. We've even got some that have reds and yellows and in the markings.
Oh, very cool.
But they're harmless. I mean, that's the good thing about them. So, you know, unless you're a grasshopper or a fly, nothing to worry about.
Oh, well, it's very cool. Michelle in Middleton has a question for you. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks, guys. I'm wondering how I can control fungus gnats on houseplants.
I had some emails on that, too.
Yeah. You know, the thing about fungus gnats is they're breeding in the organic matter that's in the potting soil. And one of the better ways of going about and fighting the fight is that there is a bacterial insecticide that you can get at some of the larger garden stores and the like that contain the protein that will kill the fungus gnat maggot. So you just sprinkle it on, and it's so selective that it doesn't kill other creatures. So it's about as benign a type of insecticide you can use. I've seen it sold under the name Gnat Out, Gnatrol, and others. You can always go on Gardens Alive. They have another version of this, but it's a form of Bacillus thuringiensis, the strain Israeliensis. So we call it BTI for short. So BTI has got the right stuff. And again, you don't have to worry about pets, kids. You just sprinkle it on the surface and they will get into it. I have seen some cases. I don't expect that to work, but these are usually very large plantings, like interior plantscapes. We had a problem on campus here back about 6 months ago at the Discovery Institute, and won't go into detail, but we had to go to a different kind of direction. But it happened to be another insect hormone that was the solution. The BTI just wasn't, in that situation, the right stuff. But in houseplants, usually I find it to do a very good job.
Thank you very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the Madison campus. Great to have him along. And he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, so stay with us. We'll be back after a quick look at the news. Taking a look today at the world of insects, Larry Mueller here, my guest Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Thanks for listening in. Questions for Phil about insects that might be bugging you, so to speak, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, and please feel free to post photos or questions on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We've had some really cool ones. Go to it anyway and take a look at what people have already posted. There's some cool ones there. Larry in La Crosse has been waiting a while, so let's go there. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Love your show. I call all the time. My question is about them paper wasps. You know, they form them big wasps, them big hives. They're kind of like gray papers things. Do them wasps, do they die in the winter? What do they do when them wasps...
There's two things that go on. They do die. They starve out because there's no food stores there. So there's no way, no matter how mild the winter is, that they could survive. But the way they get through is that in the fall of the year, the new queens come out, the males inseminate them, and then they go crawl under a rock or some other sheltered place. And then in the spring of the year, they start everything from scratch. And you might say, why don't they use the old nest? Well, this probably is a mechanism to stay away from diseases, because there could be a disease in the old nest, and so it seems to make better sense to start everything from scratch. So 1st of November is kind of the cutoff. Usually by the 1st of November, any nest that's sitting anywhere, I figure, is dormant. It's not active, and you could collect it if you want to collect it if it's big and impressive, or just leave it be. There's no reason to go climb a tree and get it out of there. And as I said, you can assure people that in the spring, if there's any wasps around, they're going to start everything from scratch somewhere else.
There you go. Thank you for that question. Ian in Oshkosh, hello to you.
Hi. I have a question about wasps, I think. I was going to paint the ceiling of a bathroom, and I saw what looked like a greasy patch, and when I touched it, my finger went through. And behind that, I found what appears to be a wasp nest, I mean, kind of like a honeycomb-type structure.
Okay.
No evidence of actually any live animals in there, but I'm wondering what I can do. First of all, are there likely to be any animals in there? And
no.
If not, what can I do to stop them coming back, or won't they come back?
Well, try to trace back as best you can where they had access to the outside. If there's a vent that wasn't screened, if there is a hole, sometimes in bathrooms you worry about vent fans, that they're caulked in and screened in properly so things don't get access. Because, you know, if they're looking for environments, you know, and I see this quite commonly in, you know, in attic spaces that have, you know, louvered vents, but they're not screened behind it. And so it's like a big hole in the wall. And so it's not surprising me that wasps and other things come in. And so that's what I would try to do is be enough of a detective to figure out where they got access to the outside and deal with that now, any time from now until the end of June, and you should be just fine.
Okay, and they're insects that eat drywall, because they've pretty much eaten all the way through except for the
No, but, you know, at times when they're expanding their space, I have seen them do this. It's not normally in their nature. Sometimes, honestly, it happens. The biggest mistake I see people make sometimes is that a nest is very active in the late summer, and they plug it. And then they will do everything they can to find a way out. And so this is the exact nightmare I worry about, is that I'm all of a sudden eating a hole through the drywall, and they're flying all over, and they're mad and whatnot.
Yeah, they're mad.
As I said, the worst mistake people can make is plug an active colony, but they're not going to be active now. And as I said, it was unfortunate, but they were probably trying to expand their space. There wasn't enough space for them, and they just figured working through the drywall would make more space for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do they sting?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. They do. Okay, because it's above my daughter's bathroom.
Okay.
Okay. Hopefully she's not listening.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much calling.
Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate the call. On our Facebook page, we have heard from Wendy, who says, my daughter's been collecting cutworm larvae in snowmelt puddles in our park. Wants to know where they would be if they weren't floating in those icy puddles. In the grass and trees, where would we find them?
Well, you know, we had a call in a number of specimens the first of the year when we had a bit of a snowstorm and people were finding dark caterpillars crawling on the snow. And that happened to be a particular species that we call the winter cutworm, which is a European species. It's only been in the state for about 10, 12 years now. And they overwinter as full-grown larvae. And just like woolly bear caterpillars and other things, you get the right conditions and they kind of get active at some pretty silly times. But what they will be doing very shortly is burrowing into the ground, pupating, and then transforming into the adult cat or moths that we would see typically in June. And so, as I said, I'm just guessing, but the chance of it being one of these winter cutworms, I think, is pretty high because it's one of the few critters that would be at that life stage at this time of the year. And especially in the western edge of the state, we got many, many complaints, you know, up into Spooner and that part of the state. The winter cutworms were really quite active this past year.
Wolfgang in Sparta, hello to you.
Yes, good afternoon. I live on a tree farm in the Cooley country just outside of Sparta. And late last summer, I noticed what is apparently some kind of ground nesting bee or wasp that I've never encountered before. What's unique about this one is that it apparently excavates a large hole in the ground. The hole might be as much as a foot in diameter. It is flat-bottomed and anywhere from 8 to 10 inches deep, something I'd never seen before. I'd like to know if anybody has any idea what this is.
Well, most likely it's the ground-nesting paper wasps. You know, we see the big wasp nests up in the trees, and that's one group, but we have a number of them that go into void spaces, and those are the ones that get in the siding of people's houses and make a paper wasp nest there. Or typically in nature, they are, again, in old ground burrows of rabbits and, you know, chipmunks and the like. They're not efficient diggers on their own. Now, can they excavate a little bit of soil out of a pre-existing hole? Yes. But to start from scratch and dig a hole that big, no way. That's just not their behavior. But, you know, they do construct these very large nests, and there can be literally 4,000 or 5,000 wasps or up to that number in the late summer. And this is the one where we have trouble when people mow over it or, you're active. They're very tolerant unless, you know, the nest is disturbed, and then they're very aggressive. And the other thing you see quite commonly in the late summer and early fall are skunks and raccoons getting into those things because they're going after the grubs that are inside there. So sometimes people will see all of a sudden a big hole dug, part of a wasp nest sitting there broken apart, and that's what happened is during the night either a skunk or a raccoon had found that out and was trying to take advantage of a free meal.
Yes, well, I've seen several of these, and there haven't been any indication of, like a digger piling up dirt beside it or anything. There's no dirt piled up around it, and it's just an open, flat-bottomed hole.
Yeah, but see, again, I go back to if there was a big rabbit burrow, and, you know, sometimes these things collapse, so you don't know they're there, but the space of the hole, you know, it doesn't surprise me, the size of a basketball or so. I mean, that's kind of what I would expect. But as I said, it's just not their nature to be diggers. You're finding that they're finding a washed-out area, something that's pre-existing. We get a lot of these nests underneath stumps and the like. Same thing, because there's usually some hollow areas they can take advantage of.
And thanks a lot for calling, Wolfgang. Jason in Rockford, Illinois, has something similar here. Jason, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
In my backyard, I've got kind of like a slight hillside. And like you said, they look like a wasp or a hornet insects, but they're 2 to 3 times larger than the normal, you know, wasp or hornet that I'm used to seeing. And I've actually watched them burrow into the side. side of this hillside and kind of scoot their hind end and shoo the dirt back out of their hole.
Mm-hmm.
And we've actually had the holes professionally treated with some sort of a powder, but they keep coming back, and it seems like they're coming back in more force every year. There's more and more holes.
Okay. It is likely a cicada killer, but even if it's not a cicada killer, the difference between your wasp and the one we just talked about, those are colony wasps. You've got a queen. She has a bunch of children we call workers. They make a nest. You have what are called a solitary wasp. So you have multiple holes. Each female digs her own burrow. In the case of cicadas, she catches cicadas, puts them down in there to feed her young. When she's done with it, that's it. She lays her egg. It's not a true nest in the sense, at least the way I think of a nest. The important point here is that solitary wasps are very non-aggressive. There's no nest to defend, and so there's no reason for them to be very, very aggressive on people. The other side of the story, though, is you could treat and kill everything that's there. Next year, some come flying in from down the road and start it. It's all about the habitat. Anything you can do on that side hill to get more vegetation, to get it covered, they like barren soil type areas. If you had thick grass or other kinds of cover that they couldn't find the soil, they wouldn't be there. And so if there's a way you can attack it that way, although I'll go back to the point, is that this kind of wasp is extremely non-aggressive. It's really not that important to get rid of them. But if you don't want them there, I would look at the more permanent solution, which is the modification of what's going on rather than trying to treat. You could treat it yourself. You could put some garden dust like 7 into the holes, and then they come and go. That would do them in. But that's something you may have to do every late summer. And this in particular is more of a late summer critter. We don't see it in the spring.
Hmm. Okay, because, I mean, like I said, they're giants, and it's right near where my kids and, you know, pets go. So, I mean, they're terrified of them, and it's...
Yeah, I can see where they're afraid, you know, and if one flew down my shirt, I wouldn't want to get... The females can sting, the males can't. But as I said, I think going back to the way of thinking about it, if there wasn't barren soil there, because a lot of times you see them in flower beds, because, again, you have that same kind of mixture. We got them here on campus. Look up cicada killer, because I said what you're describing fits. They're a relatively new pest to us in Wisconsin. It used to be an Indiana insect when I was a young entomologist, but we're seeing a lot of these southern things move northward is because of the lack of cold weather, and we've had enough cicadas. In fact, we even did a shoot with Shelley Ryan that's going to be on this spring and the Wisconsin Gardener about cicada killers and what they're about and how to deal with them. So,
there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Norman in Wausau, I want to give you a chance next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for having your guest on. He's always interesting. I have two bee questions. One is kind of a follow-up to his orchard bee thing. I have the block that's pre-drilled, and I have a little hobby orchard, and I'd like to have those bees around my orchard for pollination. So I put it on the northwest corner against a fence post where I don't spray with anything. But in 2 years, I've yet to get any activity in that block. What's the problem there?
Well, it may just be that there's none in the neighborhood. You know, that's always a concern. Even though they are scattered throughout the state, you know, if there isn't some native populations close by, then they don't find your stuff to utilize. So in that case, you know, if this has been consistent, this may be a case where you do order a set of already, you know, a bee blocks from out west, release them in the spring, and then have other habitats so they can start to self-sustain themselves. So it's not something I think you'd have to do every year. But if you can't seem to attract something locally, as I said, I'm nervous that there isn't anything too close by, and then you're going to have to kind of seed it if you think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I have this bumblebee nest, one of these professionally made ones with two chambers. It's got the cotton in one side. It's got a plexiglass cover under the top cover. So if you want to see what's going on, you can just gently lift the cover without disturbing them, and they can't fly out at you to see what's going on. And I've tried to capture what I think are the females early in the spring, and you put one in there, and I put it down near the ground. But for some reason, they leave, and I never have any bees in it.
Yeah,
bumblebees.
I have seen queens find a place to set up, you know, and are active for a week, and then all of a sudden they decide they want to find someplace else. And so it, you know, what you're doing is exactly what I would try to do to see if I could tease one in. But they are a little bit, I don't say temperamental, but sometimes, as they said, yeah, picky is a better way.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. An email from Lewis. What's the best way to get rid of my small yard of grubs to thwart the moles later?
Okay. The thing I always warn people about here is that although many things you find on the internet informationally say, well, moles eat grubs, they also eat earthworms. In a lot of cases, I've seen people poison their lawn to kill the grubs, and the moles don't go away because there's still worms to eat. And so, you know, Dr. Craven, I'm sure, has talked about this before, but yeah. If you're really serious about mole control, the harpoon traps seem to be the most efficient use to set them up. They're rather labor-intensive, but you're reducing the problem itself. And as I said, my concern in Wisconsin typically is I don't see that many cases where it is grub-driven why the moles are there. It's more worm-driven, and we don't have anything that kills earthworms.
How about a call from Dick here in Waukesha? Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Larry and Phil. You remember me? I was at the Retzer Nature Center when you were the guest speaker a year or two ago, and when you entered the room, a moth or a butterfly came in with you and lit on my head or shoulder.
That was pretty
everybody
magical.
Clapped.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I had that talent, but
that's not
as you
why
said.
I called. What do you call the critters that live in those gray paper bags, 12, 15 feet up and hanging from a branch?
Typically, the most common species is the ball-faced hornet, but it is a paper wasp. It is the biggest paper wasp, and for that reason, it makes the biggest nest. And the nest is enveloped or enveloped with an outer shell. We have some other species of wasp that you can see the comb in there, and that typically is a genus called Polistes. There are some smaller species of yellow jackets that also are aerial nesters. So you really kind of have to see the size of the critter to be sure. But the bald-faced is, you know, almost an inch long, dark black with a big whitish-yellow face.
Have you been stung by one?
Yes, and in the scheme of things, it's about as nasty a sting as you can get in the state.
I had one stung me on the shoulder some years ago. It felt like somebody hit me with a hammer.
Yeah, it's a bigger wasp. It's got more venom, so I guess I'm not totally surprised. Hard to get them to sting, but you can. I remember my dad at one time, and I don't know where he came up with this idea. We had a ball-faced hornet nest at the neighbor's place, and he went with a lit piece of newspaper thinking he was going to deal with it. And so, of course, he didn't get very close to it before he got stung a bit. And I was just wondering, even if he got to the nest and started, then my neighbor's house is on fire. This is not good. So,
oh, man, there you go. Thanks for calling, Dick. Appreciate it. Doug in Lake Mills. Hello.
Yeah, hi. This past summer, last year, I saw my first ever praying mantis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious, how common are praying mantises in the state?
Used to be a total non-issue because they could not survive our winters. The species we see is a Chinese species, but it has established in the southern part of the state. I was at a Brewers game last year, and one flew on a person next to me. I was at a Badger football game this year, and one went flying over the crowd. And so there are breeding populations, at least in the southern two tiers of counties and also in Door County, and I expect them to extend their range. And again, it goes back to, their egg masses are susceptible to cold temperatures, but it's not cold enough anymore. And so the eggs are surviving, hatching, and so now we're seeing them move normally throughout the state.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Sally in Land O'Lakes. Hi, Sally.
Hi there. Every summer, we get these big spiders on our pier, and they seem to live underneath the pier.
Mm-hmm.
I've asked the person who puts our pier in and out, what are these spiders? And he says he didn't know. He calls them pier spiders.
No, but to be honest, they are called fishing spiders.
Fishing.
If you look under the internet under fishing spiders, it's a whole family of spiders. They even have the capacity to feed on small fish and go in underwater and come back out. And you will find them away from water, 100, 200 yards. That's not unusual, but they're very big. They are the biggest spider that I know of in the state. The genus most common is Dolomites. But as I said, you just do a search on fishing spider, and I'm sure you'll see what you're seeing there.
They bite? Would they bite us?
If you could handle one. They do have the capacity to bite. There's nothing really dangerous about the bite, but it would be painful. I mean, it's a pretty big spider, so
right.
Just like some of the big wolf spiders. But it's going to be very difficult. I mean, they're not going to go, they're not aggressive. They're not going to come running after you. And as I said, so I don't know if I've ever talked to anybody who was being bit by one, but they do have the potential.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Sally. Ann in Saukville. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some kind of teeny, teeny, tiny brown beetle-like bug in my kitchen. It is capable of making perfectly round holes into boxes of pasta and biscuit-like dog treats.
Sure.
I don't know. And I
It is called a drugstore beetle. And honestly, I wouldn't have been able to go there until you told me about this, the holes, because that's characteristic. They're a pest of all kinds of pet food, dry goods, spices, potpourri. And the game here is that, you know, you find out one box of dog treats and you get rid of it, but they're capable of laying their eggs and infesting other things. And so it takes kind of going through all your dry goods and look for what's infested. You can dispose of it. But then things that you have around for an extended period of time, consider a substantial kind of container, screw-top jars, Tupperware, something more than just a baggie, because that's not sufficient to keep them out. And, you know, once you go through the sanitation, that's the control. I always tell people you can't spray for them because they're in food. And if you don't find the bad box of Bisquick, you still got critters. And so, but you got to keep your mind that anything that's dried plant material. So, again, I see them in straw flowers, you know, just lots of weird things. Pet food, though, it seems to be notorious for being infested. And so if you got a bag of dog treats you forgot about back in a closet, that can continue to be the source of this stuff for months.
Hmm. There you go. So do a little detective work.
Yeah, and the name drugstore beetle is derived from back in the olden days before all the fancy chemistry. You know, it was the roots of this, the leaves of that were used for medicinal purposes. And if one of these things got in there, they would eat all that stuff up. And so that's the association.
Thanks, Ann. Bill in Waupaca, hello.
Good morning, or afternoon. I have a follow-up question on those powder post beetles.
Yeah.
The word dry, is there any other way of drying out something, like with heat, hair dryer type heat or something? I know it would be time-consuming, but would that get rid of them, and how long would that take?
Well, you know, it comes back to the ideal moisture level of the wood runs somewhere between 12 to 13% up to 20. If it gets wetter than that, it's too wet. That being said, it's somewhat unrealistic to get wood down to below 10 or 11%. And I have even seen them survive wood at 8%. I had a guy that made a guitar out of ash, and 2 years later a powder post beetle came. What happens when the wood is excessively dry, it takes them a very long time to complete their life cycle because things aren't right. So could they infest a piece of sealed wood that's at 10%? No. I wouldn't expect it. They usually start with higher moisture levels. The trouble is our wood goes up and down with moisture levels just with the humidity in the summer. The levels are higher in the winter. But in our climate, we are blessed that we tend to be on the drier side, especially because of what we do in the winter versus in a place like Louisiana. In Louisiana, powder post beetles go through 3 cycles a year. The norm up in Wisconsin is 1 a year, I will tell you that sometimes I see a beetle take 4, 5, 6 years to do its thing, just because, again, things aren't ideal. The other factor that you have no control over is the amount of starch in the wood, and they like high starch. So you'll even see in a piece of flooring, they're in one corner, not the other, and the explanation probably is the starch level, and then maybe secondarily the moisture level that's affecting it. So hair dryer, you know, again, crawl spaces, things that you can do to aerate it, basements, putting dehumidifiers, all of those things are heading the right direction. I'm not so sure you could get it done with a hairdryer.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. And Phil, thank you so much. Boy, I don't know how many calls we took today or questions.
Maybe we set a new record. I want Dr. Craven to remember that.
Phil Pelletieri will be back probably in about a month. Entomologist with UW Extension and the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got a link to his diagnostic lab. Lots of great things, great photo pictures of insects for you to see. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.